Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the show today. Over the years, I've read many surveys that consistently ranked America as the unhappiest nation on earth. That question sparked today's show. Why, when we have so much, why are we so unhappy? And most importantly, what can we do about it? So I started looking around for some good answers and was amazed at just how many books and programs and courses there are devoted to the pursuit of happiness. Out of the 60,000 books in print today, I chose today's guest because I wanted material that provides tangible tools and practical exercises to help us get happy and stay happy. My guest is Michael Neal. He's the author of Feeling Happy Now. He's an internationally renowned success coach and licensed master trainer of neuro-linguistic programming. He's written hundreds of articles in the areas of business, success, money, relationships, health, happiness, and his weekly coaching column is syndicated in newspapers and magazines worldwide. He's also the creator of the Effortless Success audio program and has spent the past 16 years as a coach, advisor, and mentor to celebrities, CEOs, royalty, and people who simply want to get more out of their lives. Michael Neal, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Pleased to have you. I just said before the show, this is a really great book. I mean, you said at the beginning of your book, there are 60,000 books in print right now on happiness. And
there's probably more. That was written over a year ago now.
There you go. So with all of those books in print, why did you feel the need to write another one?
I mean, no, it's the right question, because I started out when I was I worked in bookshops in my while I was in college, and I worked in a psychology bookshop and a New Age bookshop in London, and I noticed after a little while that there were about 10 books that had been rewritten about 1,000 times each, and I sort of determined at that point if I ever was going to write one, it was not going to be one of those 10 books. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons why I had been doing this for nearly 20 years before I wrote about it. You know, because there was no point for me in just writing another version of do this and, you know, get this and then you'll feel happy.
Sure.
First off, because it doesn't work.
Right.
Not sustainably. But secondly, because of that, because you know, if somebody else had already said what I wanted to say, I would just recommend their book.
Yeah, and that's the reason I liked this book was it was not a rehash of many of the others out there, because I did look at a lot when I was selecting some the topic for this show. And you know what I loved? I loved on your book jacket that you're described as a creative spark plug.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Shall I tell you how hard I had to fight with marketing to let them to have them let me put that there?
Oh, really?
They're like, nobody knows what that is.
No.
Can we just call you this?
Well, you say that coaching as a coach, you're a catalyst. So go ahead and expand on that a little bit and a little bit about what you mean by a creative spark plug.
Yeah. One of the reasons that I can do what I do with such a wide range of people, and you know, I know my resume of clients is always very impressive sounding, and they're very impressive people. But the reason that I can work with them, and you know, work with somebody in a homeless shelter, and work with people who come on seminars, is because there are certain fundamental things that I know about people, and that's when they tap into their innate well-being and their inspiration and you know, what they have inside them, they can do amazing things. And so my job isn't to get them to do something that they can't already do or that they give them something they don't already have, which could be difficult. It's just to find what's already there. Mm. And while there's no one way to do that I've found that is going to work with everybody, if you know it's there, you're more inclined to keep going till you find it.
Sure. Another of the reasons I chose your work over, you know, other people's work, which was also very good, but I particularly like the fact that you've really walked your talk. You weren't always such a happy chappy, as we say back home, right?
Yeah. Miserable bastard, is that the word you're looking for? No, I mean, I was. I mean, I grew up for no good reason, which I think is actually important. In other words, I didn't have a difficult life. I just was deeply, deeply depressed, and, you know, ultimately suicidal. And because that was my background, I didn't get into psychology to help people. I got into psychology to not die.
Mm.
And I think that's one of the reasons that my approach is different, because it's based purely on what actually worked.
Yeah.
And what I found since then is consistent, because some things are obviously idiosyncratic to my story and my journey.
Yeah, and you actually share that story in the book, and you say that you were on the point of, you know, either giving your brain over to doctors to tell them, you know, they could tell you what to do with it, or take control yourself, and that's when your journey began.
Yeah, and it was an extraordinary night, because I started just sobbing, and this was probably 11 o'clock at night, and after like an hour and a half, I thought, do you know what? This isn't normal. It was like, even though I had a history of being depressed, even I got, that's kind of not normal. And I went down to I was at university at the time, and I went to the infirmary and the night nurse. She just found me on the step, and she rocked me back and forth and cradled me. And she kept having me say the Lord's Prayer over and over again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny, because I actually only knew it because I had just done a deaf theater production of Jesus Christ Superstar, and it's in there. And, you know, but so we're doing this, and I'm feeling comforted, and I can now, you know, look at that, and I can, with my psychological insight now, you know, I can say, ah, well, you know, we created a repetitious, almost mantra-like effect. The rocking had an almost hypnotic effect that calmed me. There may have been, you know, her love, you know, triggered something in me. There may have been a spiritual element, all that. But at the time, I remember all I thought is, I feel better.
Mm.
And, you know, and they were really sweet. And I've got to say this to them, even though their way of intervening is not the way that I recommend for most people. They were really, actually, I was fortunate enough to have people that were very, very kind about it. And that kindness went a long way. But when they put me in the room, awaiting a doctor, because it was the middle of the night, there was no one there, and they were going to admit me in the morning, but they were going to give me something to help me sleep. I got so clear so quick. It was like, I fortunately don't have first-hand experience of this, but it's what I imagine it might be like if you were a little bit over the limit and you saw a police siren in your rearview mirror.
Uh-huh.
I sobered up quick, emotionally. And I just thought, oh, hang on, this has now gone beyond something that's self-contained that I'm dealing with on my own. If I let them go ahead with this and give me a little something to help me sleep and then check in, you know, that's, I've just entered a whole new world.
Yeah.
And I decided in that moment that I wasn't ready to give up. In fact, I hadn't really started on finding something in myself to sort it out. And so I was on the, I tried to go out the door, but the nurse was at the end of the hallway, and I couldn't face her because she'd been so nice to me. But fortunately, I was only on the first floor, so I went out the window, and that was the beginning of the
escape.
That was the first day of the rest of my life.
There you go. And how different your life might have been had you stayed there and you know, given in to however they were trying to help you.
Yeah, and again, they would have tried to help me in the best way they knew. It would have been with such innocence and in that place, at least, with a lot of care. That doesn't mean that it would have been the best way.
Mm.
It just means that, you know, I couldn't hold them accountable, you know, in a moral sense for it. You
right.
do the best you can to help others.
Why, Michael, do you think happiness is so elusive for so many people?
Why happiness is so elusive?
Mm.
I think because they're looking in the wrong place. I think it is that simple. I mean, you just aren't going to find, a nice shirt in a toy shop. It doesn't matter if it's the best toy shop in the world. You're not going to find a nice shirt there.
Right.
And if you look for happiness in the world by getting things a certain way, I'll be happy when. And this is one of the big myths of happiness. I'll be happy when I've got the right partner. I'll be happy when I've got enough money. I'll be happy when I get a good job or I'm doing something I really love. I'll be happy when the wars end. I'll be, you know, whatever it is, that you aren't going to find it there because that's not where it is. Happiness is, always has been, always will be, innate part of our nervous system, and I believe beyond even the nervous system, you know, part of our essential humanness.
Yeah, and this is what makes also differentiates your book from many of them out there. You don't look back. You make happiness now. You talk about making happiness now. And your book's actually divided into three parts: feeling good, feeling better, and finally, feeling happy. So there's a natural process there, tangible tools and resources. And I wonder if, before we dive further into that, if you can just define neuro-linguistic programming. I think most people have heard that term, but there's some confusion sometimes about what it actually means.
Sure. I mean, neuro-linguistic programming, or NLP is the more common way that it's talked about, is basically the study of how language impacts our nervous system and how our habits of thinking impact our experience of life. And, you know, my work isn't based purely on NLP, but that was my initial grounding. And what it's done is it's given me a framework to filter things through. So even when I've come across other psychologies and other ways of looking at things, I've learned how to break them down into what are the elements that actually matter and what's the woo-woo sounding hype.
Right, right.
And so it's been a very useful framework for me to have in developing my own work, because it just lets you take things apart in useful ways. So, NLP, when used at its best, gives you access to your own nervous system. So things that seem to just happen to you, well, they walked into the room and said that to me, and I just got upset. I worked with a client yesterday on Friday, who came out because he's phobic of dogs. And, you know, an hour later, and I've got a picture of him, kissing my dog.
Uh-huh, interesting.
What you learn as you start to learn how to use your brain for a change and how to use your body in certain ways is that it's not random. It's not, it doesn't just happen. You actually have to do very specific things in your head in order to create those feelings, those fears, the depression, and all the other stuff. Okay. And if you do different things, you get a different result.
Well, let's look at how we do create our personal experiences. You say there are three variables behind the structure of our subjective experiences: body, mind maps, and the stories we tell ourselves. I wonder if we can let's take a look with the body, how we use our body.
I mean, the easiest thing in the world to experience is the difference that it makes in your body. And I mean, look, you're listening right now. If you sit, as you're listening, the way that you would sit if you were kind of bored and thought this was dull, and hopefully everyone's actually shifting at home and not going, yes, your point. Yeah. But if you sit that way, you'll notice you move your body to do that, and that immediately creates a different experience. Now, if you sit the way that you sit, if you were a little bit curious about what we're talking about, if you were wondering, well, you know what, I'm not sure that there's anything here, but maybe he's going to say something that I'll be able to use. Maybe I'm going to hear something in this interview that actually will impact my life. Mm. Again, most of you are going to shift, and your experience of listening to his talk is going to be different. Now, if you sit the way that you would sit, if you actually knew that in the next 2 minutes, I'm going to share something that is actually going to take whatever is the biggest problem you're experiencing in your life right now, and you'll know exactly how to solve it, if you just listen to what I say for the next 2 minutes, again, you sit differently. You're going to hear different things. Now, if you do that for the next hour, you're going to have a very different experience of this interview than you would if you were just sitting the way that you would sit when you were bored and tired.
Right.
So that's not all there is to it, but that's a really quick access that we've got in any moment.
Right.
To shift your state.
Let's look at mind maps, because I know all of these work together. And you say that in order to make sense of the world, we represent the information we take in through our five senses inside our mind.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most extraordinary, and I actually don't remember if I tell this story and feel happy now or if it's in You Can Have What You Want, but it was one of the most extraordinary experiences I ever had was I went on television in the UK on a show called Carol Vorderman's Put It to the Test, and they wanted to test the NLP phobia cure. And so they brought in three people who had phobias of spiders. And in the dress rehearsal, we just walked through, and they had them hooked up to these EKG and EEG machines, and they had a couple of doctors there from the local hospital. And the idea was that we'd see how their brains and bodies reacted to the spiders, and then after I worked with them, we'd see if it was different. Well, in the dress rehearsal, they're hooked up to the machines, and the stage manager brings out an empty, clear plastic container and says, during the show, we're going to put spiders in this. And all three people spiked on the machines.
Oh, really?
And that was when I really, really got, you're not afraid of what you think you're afraid of. You're afraid of what you think. In other words, it's not spiders that any of these people were scared of, because there were no spiders in the building. It's the thought of spiders. And once you get the difference, the thought has a structure. And for almost everybody who's got that kind of fear, the structure is pretty predictable. It's a horror movie. You know, you know, you might think of, you and I might think of a dog and think Lassie, you know, the guy who came to me last week.
Yes.
Thought of a dog and thought Cujo.
Yes, really.
You know, when you change the map, your experience completely changes. And that's the reason why you can change so quickly, is because the problem, no matter how real it felt, was actually in your head. Now, it was also in your body, because whatever happens in your head is reflected in your body and vice versa. But once you start to get that the thing between you and happy is just a thought, it becomes easier to deal with, even when you haven't gotten rid of the thought. Just knowing it's just a thought sometimes is enough to lessen the charge.
Right. So in that particular instance that you just used as an example, when you were on television and, you know, told these people that there were going to be spiders in the glass jars, how did you turn that thinking around for them?
Well, it's actually, in that instance, it's I hate to say it's simple, but it really is. Once you understand how the mechanism works, you can just use the mechanism differently. Once you get that it's just a thought, you look at, okay, what is the thought? What does it look like? What pictures do you have in your head? What sounds do you hear? You know, where in your body do you feel it? Feelings, in order to feel them in our body, move in certain directions. They spin. And sometimes they spin clockwise, counterclockwise, up, down. When you get the spin, if you reverse the spin of the feeling, it changes it. It messes with it in a way that you can't go back to doing it the other way. If you run a film backwards, it won't look the same the next time you run it forwards.
Okay.
So you're literally scrambling the old connection in the brain, which creates the opening for a new learning to happen.
Okay. I remember doing an exercise like this in L.A. with Tony Robbins. And he had us, in my situation, I worked with somebody who, at that time, believe it or not, terrified me. And he had me imagine her with a clown nose and orange hair and,
exactly.
You know, and talking in weird voices.
Now you think of that and laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, again, that's because the only reason that can work is because you were never terrified of her. You were terrified of the movie you made in your head of her.
Mm. Yeah. Makes sense.
Because if it was really her, that wouldn't have done it.
Right. Makes sense. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to look at the third variable behind the structure of our experiences, and that is the stories that we tell ourselves.
One of my very favorites.
Ah, good. Well, please stay tuned. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest today is Michael Neal. He's the author of Feel Happy Now.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Erin Gruwell thought she was just doing her job. Instead, she became the personification of how one person can truly make a difference in the lives of those who are struggling. Her teaching was so inspirational that Hollywood took her story to the big screen, and Erin was portrayed by Academy Award winner Hilary Swank. Now, Erin Gruwell talks with Vicky St. Clair to share her insights into the embodiment of giving service and how it can turn around the lives of others and save ourselves. Join us next Monday at noon for Teach With Your Heart, right here on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's the Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss the Radio 8 Ball Show at its new time, Fridays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
Like what you hear? Be sure and support the sponsors who support your favorite programs on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for being with us today. We are talking with Michael Neal. His book is called Feel Happy Now, and you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Forgot my own name for a moment. And before the break, we're talking about the three variables behind the structure of subjective experiences. And the first was body, second was mind maps. And the third is the stories that we tell ourselves. And Michael, you said that's your favorite, so fire away.
And the reason that it's my favorite is because it's ever present, and people can usually hear it quite quickly once they know what to listen for. And it's everyone's got that voice inside their head, and I tend to call that voice the storyteller, because that's the voice that's doing a running commentary on everything that's going on in your life, and sometimes things that aren't.
Right.
And the thing about the storyteller is, until you know that that's just a voice in your head, people think that's them. And they think that if it says something, it must be true. And if it says it often enough, it must be important. And nothing could be further from the truth. It really is just a voice in your head. Sherry Huber is a Zen teacher, and she has my favorite quote about that voice. She says, that voice inside your head is not the voice of God. It just sounds like it thinks it is.
That's so good.
And the thing is, once you get that voice isn't you, it's just a voice, for a lot of people, their life changes just from that, because it suddenly gives a distance and a perspective that allows them to tap into what I would call the deeper voice, or the inner voice, or the still small voice within, which isn't always a voice. Sometimes for some people it's a feeling or just a knowing of things. And you don't hear it. A lot of us don't think we've got an intuition, or that I never get little flashes of what to do. But it's not that they're not there. It's that there's so much other noise in your head that you can't hear it.
Right, right. There's an article under that section in the book, and it's from the New Scientist magazine by Helen Phillips. And it mentions in there that much of what we do is the result of unconscious brain processing. And she ends that article with, it's an unsettling thought that perhaps all our conscious mind ever does is dream up stories in an attempt to make sense of our world.
Mm-hmm. So, I don't find that unsettling. I find that liberating as heck.
Well, explain why.
Because as soon as I know that, then I stop trying to navigate my life by what that voice is saying. You know, it's so much a part of our lives. I mean, there are people right now talking to themselves going, I have no idea what he's talking about. I don't have a voice in my head. This is ridiculous. It's so much a part of how we experience the world, and a filter through which we experience the world, that it's invisible to us. It's like the Marshall McLuhan quote about, you know, I don't know who discovered water, but I can guarantee it wasn't a fish.
Okay.
You when something is so much a part of your experience, until somebody points it out to you, you don't believe it's there. But once you see it, once you hear it, once you notice that there's this continual storytelling going on in your life, it becomes less and less important. And it's not, and I think this is a really important distinction, it's not that you're ever going to get to the point where you don't have a voice in your head that's narrating your life. It's that it will become less and less of a factor and an impact on your experience of life. And the metaphor for that I always think is so brilliant is the movie A Beautiful Mind, where John Nash, the Russell Crowe character, you know, had these three hallucinations that to him were real people.
Mm.
And at some point, they never went away, but he simply made a decision not to interact with them anymore, not to let them guide his life. And the minute he did that, he was able to actually lead a very functional life. At least in the movie. Again, I know there's some discrepancies in the real world there.
Right, right. You have an exercise in there called creating a good feeling. I wonder if we could just run through that for our listeners really quick. And I know it's kind of similar to the one we just did, but this is the reverse state, and we're going to now feel good instead of feeling bad.
Oh, absolutely. So if you want to do it, just literally just notice how you're feeling in your body right now. And it doesn't matter. You can give it a name. Oh, I feel horrible. I feel light. I feel good. You might just notice sensations. You might notice what your shoulders feel like or what your knees feel like. And then just shift your body until you're feeling just a little bit better than you were a moment ago. So, I mean, for some people that might be sitting up straighter. It might be, you know, a stretch. It might be a smile. You know, some people just take a nice breath, you know. And just doing that, just shifting your body, you're going to get a better feeling. Now, speak to yourself in a friendly voice. Say something nice to yourself in your head or out loud. I'm not listening. You know, so, you know, compliment yourself or remember a time where somebody said something nice about you and you kind of knew that they meant it. And just enjoy what it feels like to, you know, hear somebody say something nice about you, even if that someone is you. And then when you've done that, so you're sitting or using your body in a little different way, you're talking to yourself maybe in a different way than you're used to, go ahead and make a picture of yourself in your head and imagine how you would look if you were just a little bit happier than you are right now. How would you know? What would you see that would let you know that that person who looks and sounds remarkably like you was just a little bit happier than you are now? And when you can kind of see that for yourself, even if you don't see it like a photograph, just go ahead and step into that picture so that you're seeing through their eyes and, you know, hearing through their ears, feeling what it feels like to be inside their body. And you can do that, you know, hopefully for most of you, you've experienced a little bit of a shift. You feel a little bit better. Well, you can do that again. And then you can do that again. And you can do that as many times as you want until you're really resting in a good feeling. Now, there's an element of, well, that's just a trick. I just tricked myself into feeling good. Well, yeah, and you trick yourself into feeling bad all day long, too.
True.
So I'm not saying that the only way to feel happy is by, well, I'm going to have to always remember to use my body this way and use my voice this way and make these pictures. But it's really an opening. If you can make yourself feel even a little bit better, then you can actually be happy. And you can, and being happy, not in an abstract philosophical sense, but in feeling good feelings in your body and thinking good thoughts in your head right now.
And doesn't this become self-perpetuating? I mean, it releases more endorphins, correct?
Yeah, and the beautiful thing, I think endorphins are if there was proof of a creator, I think endorphins are as close or at least intelligent design. Because the way endorphins work in your body, endorphins are your body's feel-good chemicals. And it's actually the equivalent of opium. Your body has these opiates. It's internal morphine. Endomorphin is actually from endogenous morphine, internal morphine. And everyone's body has a different number of receptors for these opiates, for these good-feeling chemicals. And they talk about it as the cortical lottery in some psychology courses, that not everyone is born with the same capacity to have good feelings as everyone else. But here's the wonderful thing. The more good feelings you have in your body, the more endorphins that flow through your body, the more receptors your body creates. So over time, the more good feelings you have, the greater your capacity to feel even more good feelings in the future becomes.
Right, so it strengthens those pathways.
It actually literally, you know, this is the thing. I mean, they could have done a blood test on me when I was in the hospital back then, and it would have shown a low serotonin levels, and there would have been a chemical equivalent for what was going on with me. But that doesn't mean that the only way to change the chemical balance is by taking drugs. That's just one of the ways that they found that does it. The reason that I'm not as keen on antidepressants as other people are, and the woman who actually discovered, the scientist who discovered endorphins and did the research that led to the development of the first antidepressants, she wrote the foreword to my book. Because what she's seen is it was always intended as an aid to help people, not something to replace actually doing what you can do to run your brain and body.
Yeah, and you talk about this in the book that, I mean, there are times when it's okay to be unhappy. Embrace that.
Well, this is the other thing. I mean, I am not one of the happy police. I just don't, you know, sometimes people say, well, yeah, well, I'm unhappy. I'm angry. And I'll go, okay, good. Is that a problem? You know, it's, to me, you know, the idea, that's just a story that you're supposed to always feel a certain way all the time.
Mm.
And people can get themselves as worked up about I shouldn't be unhappy as they can about wanting to just feel better.
Yeah.
Look, you feel how you feel, and if you know that you're only one thought away from feeling better, it's a lot easier to put up with the bad feelings when you got them.
Yeah.
You don't have to take them so seriously. It's not. And what happens, of course, is we feel bad and we think, oh, I need to change the world. I need to change my, I'm so upset about this. I need to change my relationship. I'm so upset about this. I need a different job. I'm so upset about this. I need to go out and earn more money. Well, again, that's like going to the toy store for a shirt. When you feel bad, all that means is that in the moment, you've got some crappy thinking going on in your head. You know, you're thinking about some depressing things. You're sitting in a sad movie. You're sitting in a sad French film and wondering why you're crying. It's because in your head, you're sitting in a sad French film. And
right.
When the film's over, right. You won't feel so bad.
Yeah. I had an aunt, and I got laid off several years ago from a media company, which went bankrupt. And the very same week, found out that my father had severe form of cancer. And so I called her, and we were chatting. She goes, I think it was on a Thursday when I called her, and she goes, okay, you have until Sunday to be ticked off about all of this, and then you have to take action. So I think giving yourself permission to be sad or be angry, or I think that really makes a difference.
It makes a huge difference because it, and this is to do, by the way, with the structure of stress. Stress is never outside. I mean, and that for some people they go, of course, but for a lot of people that's a radical idea. You know, getting ill is not stressful. Losing somebody you love is not stressful. Changing careers or moving house is not stressful. However, 99 out of 100 people experience higher levels of stress when they're going through that because the thoughts that go through your head at times like that come so fast and furious that unless you've already got a grounding in running your own brain, you're going to get overwhelmed by them.
Mm.
What's stressful is trying to stop the flow. What's stressful is trying to make things other than the way that they are, or believing that things should be other than the way that they are. When you allow things to be as they are, then you're actually, ironically, at your absolutely most able to change them.
Right, right. You actually say in the book, in order to make something into a problem, you have to do one of two things, which you just mentioned, compare it to how things used to be and decide they shouldn't be that way again, and then compare it to how you'd like it to be and decide it should be that way now. So when we're in that state, we don't like what's happening. How do we turn that around as quickly as possible?
Well, I mean, ironically, you turn that around as quickly as possible by just recognizing what's actually going on. In other words, the second that you get that you're trying to sneak up on yourself and scare yourself, you know, the second that you get, oh, hang on, this is me. I'm the one doing this. And I'm doing it again with total innocence, with the best of all possible intentions. I'm doing it to try and either motivate myself to take action, because there's a belief in our culture that if you're miserable enough, then you'll do something. Or I'm doing it to protect myself. If I'm scared enough, then I won't have to do what I don't really want to do, or I'll be safe in some way.
Mm.
But the reality is, there are better ways of staying safe and motivating yourself. Inspiration will always take you further than unhappy motivation. Unhappy motivation is great for the first 30 seconds. You know, it's great to get you off your butt, but it doesn't sustain unless you keep yourself unhappy. And that's why you get so many people who start these big resolutions and then give them up so quickly. Because once things start to get a little bit better, the unhappy motivation's gone.
Okay. And you actually say in there, in the book, that, let me just find the quote here, that the more often we choose to be happy, the smarter we become. How come?
Well, it's an interesting thing. There's two reasons for that. There's a chemical reason, and then there's what I would call a spiritual reason. The chemical reason is because your brain is swimming in chemicals, you know, what we might call brain juice. And when the chemicals are the stress chemicals, the cortisone and the dopamine and the chemicals that create those stressful feelings in your body, your brain, the synapses don't fire as quickly, and this is all measurable. And sometimes they won't. Certain connections can't get made at all. Particularly, what tends to happen is what they call hemispheric isolation, where you won't be able to cross over from your right brain to your left brain, or vice versa. And so, under that state, you literally have less of your brain available to you. So that's the biochemical reason. Whereas when you're happy and the endorphins are flowing, your synapses are firing well, your brain is interconnected. They've actually found that the measure of intelligence is equivalent to how much cross-hemispheric connection is being made. So it's not whether your right brain is developed or your left brain, but it's the amount of connections that fire between the two halves of your brain.
Oh, interesting.
That correspond to intelligence. And when you're happy, that happens naturally. That's part of the design of the human body. So that's what I call the scientific or biological or reason. The spiritual reason is because we are all innately connected to this bigger thing than us. Okay, you know, for some people it's God, for some people it's spirit, for some people it's just a sense of whatever that energy is that physicists say makes up all matter. And when you're connected with that, you have natural access to a level of wisdom. You know, what some people call innate wisdom. I tend to call it inspiration. And that's those ahas. That's those light bulb moments. That's those out of the blue, you just suddenly know what to do kind of moments.
Mm.
And so you're most naturally receptive to that. You're most naturally aligned to that when you're happy, because that's when you're connected directly to the energy. When you're actually feeling good in your body, your brain, the storyteller quiets down, and you're more able to hear that still small voice within.
Mm.
So that's what I would call the spiritual reason.
Okay, very good. We need to get happy now then. Get smarter
yeah,
too.
Yeah, because that's going to work, because that's really going to work. Let's turn it into a must and a should and beat ourselves up about not being happy, and then it'll work.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Michael Neal. He's the author of Feel Happy Now, and you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
I said, if I can't feel it, then how could it be? No magic could happen to me. And then I saw you, I couldn't believe it. You took my heart, I couldn't retrieve it. Said to myself, what's it all about?
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Across Seattle, humans are vanishing, returning as newborn vampires. With the sun as her enemy, the moon her guiding light, Manali must battle the beast who tortured her. But first, she must face her own demons in Otherworld. Romantic Times magazine calls Gallinorin's best-selling Otherworld series vivid, sexy, and mesmerizing. Darkling by Yasmin Gallinorin, available at bookstores now. For more information, see Gallinorin.com.
Attention KKNW listeners, we have a brand new show for you every Thursday at 2 p.m. The Living Life Show, presented by Travel Host Magazine. I'm Buzz.
And I'm Robin. The Living Life Show is your weekly guide to living life better. We bring you local and celebrity guests each week who bring interesting ideas and tips on getting more out of life.
And listeners, you can win big prizes like antiques, jewelry, clothing, dining, and a special grand prize in January. So be sure to listen in every Thursday at 2 p.m. right here on KKNW, 1150 a.m.
Notice anything different? You should. There's no other station like Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m.
Welcome back, everyone. We're in the last segment of today's show. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest today is Michael Neal. He's the best-selling author of Feel Happy Now. And also, well, the best-selling author of You Can Have What You Want, right, Michael?
Yeah, that was my first book that that came out.
And I'm guessing this one's on the way, too.
I'm told it's doing well.
Yeah, it's just packed full of really good information. And I wonder, let's go ahead and give out your website because you have a lot of information on there, too.
Yeah, you can find, I do free daily and weekly tips just based on the latest work that I do. And there's a lot of resources there. So you can go to geniuscatalyst.com. And that's my playground.
Okay, so geniuscatalyst.com. All right, so so much more information that we're not going to get to today, but I'm trying to narrow it down. I want to look at what cognitive psychologists call our explanatory style, because I know from personal experience how powerful that is.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of gets back to the storytelling idea. One of the ways that you can make quick sense of how your life is comes from looking at how do you explain the good things that happen in your life, in other words, the things you like, and the bad things that happen in your life, in other words, the things you don't like. And what they found is that there are patterns, and that if you tend to explain the bad things as being permanent, that, you know, not only is this bad, but it's just one in a long string of permanent things, of bad things, and pervasive, in other words, not only is this bad in my relationship, this is my whole life sucks because of this. And personal, not only is this bad, and not only does my whole life suck, but it's my fault. Well, that's a pessimistic explanatory style, and that will tend to be consistent throughout your life, unless you actively change it. And it's just learned behavior. Some of us have learned a positive explanatory style or an optimistic one. Some of us have learned a pessimistic one. Until you know about it, that's just going to be how you see the world. The second you know about it, you can begin to shift it. Because what they've also found, and this is research that was first published in a book called Learned Optimism by Martin Seligman, who's the president and leader of the whole positive psychology movement now, is that if you start to explain the good things in your life as being permanent, pervasive, and personal, in other words, it's not just that this good thing happened, but good things always happen to you, and it's not just in this one area that things have gotten better. It's going to positively affect every area of your life. And not only did it all happen, but it's down to you. You're involved in making it happen, and you explain the bad stuff as temporary, specific, and impersonal. In other words, well, yeah, that bad thing happened, but it was only today. And yeah, that bad thing happened, but it was only in this one area. And yeah, that bad thing happened, but, you know, sometimes stuff happens that's outside of your control. Mm. It's very quick to move on. And sometimes when I explain that to people, they go, well, but that's just making it up. And that's exactly right. And you're making it up all day long. And the rule of thumb that I use is if you're going to make stuff up, make up good stuff.
There you go. You can't argue with that. One of the things that I really liked in here, because I think often when people are unhappy or feeling, you know, a bit low, it's very hard for them to make decisions. And you have a section here called Decisions, Decisions. You have a tool you call the decision accelerator, and it's actually quite different from, you know, most of us would sit down with a list of pros and cons.
Yeah. Well, in other words, most people's decision making strategy is a variation on Ben Franklin's old one, you know, where you make a list of the good things, you make note of all the good things, and you make note of all the bad things, and then you compare notes, and one side wins. It's like, well, I wrote 10 things on this side and 4 on that side, so the side that I wrote 10 on, that must be the best decision to make.
Right.
And what I found is that with most decisions, if you go to a sort of a more right brain, less linear approach, you can get a different experience. So, I mean, if you'd like, I can talk through this.
Yeah, I would love you to. I think it's a useful tool.
Okay, so just think about a decision that you've got that you either have to make, you want to make, you know, something, you know, where there's probably only a couple choices. I could do this or I could do that. I'm not sure whether I should go there or not go there. I should be with this person or with that person. I should take this job or that job. I should eat chicken or fish. It doesn't
right,
have to be a big
right.
deal, but just whatever it is. And then just imagine that you firmly, irrevocably, just that you have decided, right, chicken. I'm having chicken. I'm going that way. I'm going to be with this person. And imagine that you've done that. Who would you tell? Who would be the first person you'd tell that you made the decision? And what would you say to them? And what would you tell them that, you know, you're particularly excited about having made that decision? And how would they react? And how do you feel, you know, having made that decision? And now just imagine that it's a year later, so we're into 2009, and you've been living with the results of that decision for a year. And things have gone well. You know, it worked out well. Not perfectly, but it worked out well. What have been the best things about having made that decision? And what are the things that didn't work out quite the way you wanted? And now looking back on it a year later, was it really a big decision? And how do you feel about having made it? And then imagine it's 10 years from now. So we're into 2018. And you're really, really happy. And you're really, really happy in yourself, not because of the decision, but you're just happy in yourself. You're happy in your life. When you think back on that decision you made back in 2008, what do you think of it now? You know, was it a big deal? Did it really contribute to your long-term happiness and well-being? And how do you feel about it? And then you can go and repeat the steps with the other thing. So I won't go through it in the same depth, but you know, mm-hmm. You made the other decision. How do you feel about it? Who do you tell? It's a year later. How do you feel now? Who do you tell? 10 years later, you know, what difference has that actually made in your life? And now, for most people, just going through that, they'll have a much clearer sense just from that. Okay, you know what? I kind of know, because most people do kind of know. But one thing, that there's two tricks that I'd actually like to share. When you get to the point where you kind of know, but you're not quite sure, there's two tricks that can really just push you the last step. One is to actually take an action based on one of the decisions. So let's say that you've decided that you want to go to a certain school. You're applying for college, and you've decided, you know what, I think I want to go to this school. So actually, go ahead and write out the letter that you would write to tell them that you've accepted that you want to go to that school, or fill out the application if you haven't applied yet. And see, having done that, if it's not the right decision for you, what will happen is you'll start to feel really uncomfortable. And this is absolutely one of the keys to happiness I'd love us to just touch on, which is that third step of the happy formula. You'll start to feel like something's wrong. And if it is the decision you really want to make, you'll feel even better and even more excited about it, having taken that tangible action. Now, there's another trick, okay? And this one you can do. You just take out a coin. I've got a coin here. Okay. And heads, you're going to do decision one, and tails, decision two. So you think of one, just so we can do this together. So I'm going to flip my coin, okay, and heads is decision one, tails decision two.
Okay, decision two.
Okay, so now just before I tell you what it is, what do you hope it is, heads or tails?
Tails.
Okay, and it's heads. I'm sorry, how do you feel about that?
Bummed.
Okay, perfect. So it's nothing to do with the coin flip, of course. It's to do with the fact that you knew before I even told you what the coin was, what you hoped it was.
Yes.
And you had that kind of bummed feeling when I told you it was the opposite.
Yeah.
You already know, 99 times out of 100, which decision to take. But it's all the stories in your head that stop you from just following that inner knowing.
And this is what makes this exercise so powerful, the way that you've described it, because if we were to sit down, if on that particular decision, if I were to sit down and write a list of pros and cons, there'd be far more pros than cons.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's not, you know, and yet I want it the other way.
Yeah, and I mean, look, one of my rules of thumb is if I catch myself talking myself into or out of anything, I know that I already know the other thing is the answer.
Right, right.
It's like there's almost this rule. I wrote about this in You Can Have What You Want, that the number of reasons you have for doing something, for making a decision, is inversely proportional to the amount you actually want to do it.
Because
when you really want to do it, you don't need reasons.
Right, right. You say we only have two reasons for disapproving of ourselves, but there's nothing wrong with us and we're perfect as we are. So I wonder if you'd talk a little on that.
God, that makes me sound so new age, doesn't it?
But it's, you know what? It's so refreshing because you're saying we're okay as we are, and we don't have to, you know, spend a year getting right before we can start getting happy.
No, and I think that's really the key to it, is to get that. Look, there may be things that you decide you want to do different in your life, and I'm all for it. But what so many people that I meet do is they use personal development as a reason to not live the life they want to live.
Mm-hmm.
They go, I can't feel happy until I've found my inner spirit. I can't be successful until I've worked on my anger issues. Look, I work with people who are playing, you know, at the top of society, and that, you know, some of them have anger issues. That might come as a surprise. You know, some of them haven't found their inner spirit. It's the two things are actually quite disconnected. And when you just kind of get, look, this is me, and I can absolutely, you know, I can make up all the stories I want about why I shouldn't be this way. But for now, this is how I am. And if I decide it really matters, you know what? I will change it. But I'm not going to wait to feel happy until things are the way they are. Because that's as soon as you say, I'll be happy when, even if that when is an internal shift, what you're doing is you're shopping for shirts at the toy shop.
Mm.
And you're just never going to find them.
True, true. And you talk a little about once we embrace a trait in ourselves, that trait no longer runs our life, because many of us try and disown a part of ourselves. And you say that if we try and disown a part of ourselves, it winds up running our life.
Yeah, and it's what they call in Jungian psychology the shadow. That basically all the things that you hate about yourself and therefore you disavow and you go, that's not me. I'm not that kind of person. Those become your baggage. Those become what you start to see are in other people around you because you've cut off from it within yourself. And I have a sort of a rule of thumb I've had since I started doing work with people come 1990, which was nobody dies. In other words, no part of yourself are you allowed to get rid of. Because what happens, the traits that you think are the most horrible, they're just simply not being used in their proper function and their proper purpose. They're not being used in the way that they're designed to be used. Aristotle said a virtue is the mean between two vices. So, you know, what for somebody is like aggression and hostility, well, that's one vice, that's one extreme. If you went to the other extreme, that might be, you know, total passivity. You know, somebody who gets totally walked over, a complete pushover. Well, somewhere in between those two is a real balance between standing up for what you want and being flexible enough to bend but not break, which is actually something that all of us would want. If you try and kill off the anger and go, I'm not an angry person,
right,
what you're actually doing is you're cutting off from a part of yourself, and each time you do that, you have less life flowing through your body. And it's one of the things I had an acting teacher years ago who used to say, I can always tell when someone's on a spiritual path. And I said, how do you do it? And he said, well, they're dead from the neck down. Because what they do is they confuse not feeling with peace.
Yes.
And the difference between apathy or not feeling and peace is peace actually feels good. Not feeling just doesn't feel like anything. And you can usually tell because people go, how do you feel? And they go, fine.
Very good. Well, I think that's good advice. I think that's good advice. We're running toward the end of the show now. I wonder, what's the one thing you want to leave our listeners with today, Michael?
I think in some ways it's that it's even simpler than my book makes it. That when it gets right down to it, your happiness, your well-being is innate. It's what's there when everything else is calmed down. Babies are born happy. Right? When a baby cries, it's not because it needs therapy. It's because there's something that it wants, and that's its way of expressing its desire to get it. But when, as we grow older, we start to think that whoever it is who brought us what we want is what brought us the good feeling. And it's an easy, it's a total innocent confusion. But as more and more of our needs are met outside of ourselves, because as babies they have to be, we start to make a connection. And of course, this is reinforced by the stories in our culture that the well-being is coming from the people outside us. When in fact, all it's doing is allowing us to return to our innate well-being.
Very good. Excellent. I am not in the business of selling books, but I think they should make this required reading at high school. I think the world would be a lot.
The business of selling books for me, I think that would be great.
A lot happier world if we did. Thank you, Michael Neal, so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And, of course, you can find more out about Michael Neal at geniuscatalyst.com. That's geniuscatalyst.com. And thanks to each of you for joining us today. If you have any questions or feedback on today's show, you can always reach me at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Or you can reach me through our website at conversationslive.net. And you'll find featured podcasts right there on the homepage. Please join us next Monday at noon. Until then, live well, live strong. And thank you for sharing this hour with us on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Erin Gruwell thought she was just doing her job. Instead, she became the personification of how one person can truly make a difference in the lives of those who are struggling. Her teaching was so inspirational that Hollywood took her story to the big screen, and Erin was portrayed by Academy Award winner Hilary Swank. Now, Erin Gruwell talks with Vicki St. Clair to share her insights into the embodiment of giving service and how it can turn around the lives of others and save ourselves. Join us next Monday at noon for Teach With Your Heart, right here on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Views expressed on the preceding program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of